Hello, hello, and welcome to Animal Voices. Today is Friday, March 8th, 2013. It's International Women's Day. My name's Alyssa. I'm joined today in studio by Tim.
Hello.
And Jackie.
Hello.
And Kelly's helping out with the controls. Thank you so much. From Community Living Show, which is coming up at 2 today. So today, Lisa Kemmerer joins us to speak about the intersection of feminism and animal rights. She's a philosopher, activist, author, and the editor of a handful of great books, including Sister Species, Women, Animals, and Social Justice, and Speaking Up for Animals, an anthology of women's voices. We have also a short review of the brand new book that's not quite on shelves yet called Defiant Daughters, 21 Women on Art, Activism, Animals, and the Sexual Politics of Meat. So Tim will bring us that chat later in the show. And finally, we feature an interview with Fireweed, a longtime animal rights activist, eco-feminist, artist, writer, and community organizer. Looking forward to all that. Speaking of what's going on in town in terms of Women's Day events, you're going to something?
Yeah. Actually, I'm not going to that anymore, but tomorrow there is a celebration actually put on by Drishti Point, another show here, and Karma Teachers. It's called Goddess Day, and it's taking place at 45 West Hastings at the Karma Teachers studio. And it's an event with some inspiring women combining yoga and spiritual teachings with some Women's Day themed film screenings. And also, I think it ends with a dance, which sounds like fun. And this isn't so much Women's Day related, but tomorrow Liberation BC will also be doing some leafleting at the Pet Expo, so hopefully you guys can make it out there. They will be meeting at 9:45 and meet at the entrance for a quick debrief and exchange of leaflets, and this is at the P&E Forum. And also, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to all the inspiring women that were founders of the Idle No More movement. That is Nina Wilson, Sylvia McAdam, Jessica Gordon, and Sheila McLean.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And I was going to mention an event that I was planning on attending tonight, but I looked it up and it's totally sold out. It's Powerful Voices, Women Rising Up, an evening of music, art, and panel discussion. That's tonight at the Vancouver Library. But yeah, sadly, it's sold out.
Oh, no.
what happened this week? Do you have some news for us?
Yes, I do. So most of it is unfortunately not that good of news. Family was shocked by that their dog was shot and killed by a hunter, and this is in Bridgewater, Nova Scotia. They're calling for a ban on snare and foot traps after their pet dog was mistaken for a coyote and shot earlier this month. The Langdale family is calling the death of Indy, a 6-year-old Siberian husky, suspicious. The family started searching for Indy after he ran away with their other dog, Bear, about a month ago. They got an online tip that someone had seen a dog, a husky, or a coyote on the handlebars dead on a four-wheeler. Days later, the hunter confessed to the Nova Scotia Department of Natural Resources that he had set a wire snare to the trap coyotes and shot and killed Indy, thinking he was a coyote. And Indy wasn't the first animal to be caught in a hunter's snare in the area. It seems to be a trend, unfortunately. And also, I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of Captain the Dog, who was found in a dumpster several months ago in Kitsilano. The man accused of beating Captain and leaving him for dead in the Westside Vancouver dumpster has had his bail revoked Tuesday and will remain in jail after allegedly breaching conditions of his release. And Brian Wilcock, the owner of the Captain, the German Shepherd, was out on recognitions after being charged in two separate incidences in 2012, cases involving criminal harassment and animal cruelty, when Vancouver police arrested him last week. The court proceedings were subjected to a publication ban, and details of what information could be shared between lawyers and the judge cannot be printed. However, the 26-year-old will remain in custody as he awaits court dates for last year's alleged incidents, as well as this latest encounter with police. Four animal rights activists also appeared at the bail hearing and were seen shaking their heads as Crown lawyer Jacinta Lawton described the latest charges the accused is facing. Kat Chapman, who attended the hearing in the support of Captain's memory, said she was happy with the judge's decision to revoke Whitcock's bail. And U.S. proposal to ban cross-border polar bear trade fails, unfortunately. A proposal by the United States to ban cross-border trade in polar bear and their parts was defeated Thursday at an international meeting of conservationists, marking a victory for Canada's Inuit over their big neighbor to their south. Delegates at the triennial meeting of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, rejected Washington's proposal to change the status of the polar bear from a species whose trade is merely regulated, not banned. The proposal fell far short of two-thirds needed to pass, garnering 38 votes in favor, 42 against, and 46 abstentions. A similar proposal was defeated 3 years ago at the last CITES meeting. While support for most of the meeting's 70 proposals covering the trade in other species fell along predictable lines, the U.S. proposal made for some odd bedfellows, and Russia endorsed Washington's proposal, which was also supported by a cluster of animal humane societies. Okay, and another story of leg traps. A coyote was found in a leg trap in Abbotsford, and Abbotsford is being called for a ban on these leg traps. A gruesome discovery in Abbotsford on Saturday has an animal rights group demanding changes. On March 2nd, a local couple discovered a coyote with its leg in a leg hold trap caught in some branches in a wooden area of Beaton Road. Critter Care Wildlife Society of Langley was contacted. However, due to the severity of its mangled leg, the 1 to 2.5-year-old coyote had to be euthanized. Now the Fur Bear Defenders is reiterating its call for reform on leg hold traps in BC and asking the city of Abbotsford to stop any city-endorsed use of traps. According to Fox, trapping occurs in BC more often than people realize, especially in the Fraser Valley, and some of it is endorsed by municipal governments. So hopefully this will put an end to that barbaric practice.
Thanks, Jackie.
Mm-hmm.
And now for our feature interview. Lisa Kemmerer is a philosopher activist dedicated to working against oppression, whether on behalf of environment, non-human animals, or disempowered human beings. Her books include In Search of Consistency, Ethics and Animals, Call to Compassion, Reflections on Animal Advocacy, and Primate People, Saving Non-Human Primates Through Education, Advocacy, and Sanctuary. Lisa has hiked, biked, kayaked, backpacked, and traveled widely, and is currently an associate professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University, Billings. I spoke with her yesterday on the phone about two of the compilations of essays that she edited, one called Sister Species, Women, Animals, and Social Justice, and the other one called Speaking Up for Animals, an anthology of women's voices. That one came out just last year. And Sister Species the year before. Just one apology for a little bit of the sound quality with her voice. Not sure what was up with that, but it still sounds pretty good. And note, in one of my first questions, I said she wrote the books. She didn't actually write the entire book. She wrote the long introductions and framed them, but they are essay compilations. So here's that interview. So welcome to Animal Voices, Lisa, and a special thanks for joining us today in honor of International Women's Day.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's certainly our pleasure. So you've written two amazing books in the last few years focused on women and animal activism. We'll start with Sister Species, since you wrote that first in 2011. In the intro to that book, you shared that you came to feminism late in your academic career after you wrote your dissertation on animal ethics. You write that the work of compiling it was a part of a big shift away from what you called the white heteropatriarchal perspective. Can you expand on that shift and how Sister Species came to be?
I would now call that not so much a shift, but a building that I want to add to my hat all the new things that I've learned. And I want to keep the old. There's value in that. It's just richer now because I have a sense of a whole lot of other voices out there that weren't included in my education. When I went through school, all I got was the white male conventional perspective.
And you read, what was it, The Pornography of Meat by Carol J. Adams. Is that right?
Yeah. And I had, of course, known of her from the movement, but Then when I got done reading all the things I had to read for my classes, I got busy and read some of the things that I really wanted to read. And I also had a chance at the university I'm teaching at now to teach a class on, it's called Women's Philosophy and Religion. And so, of course, I include the strong feminist perspective, and of course I include animal ethics. So Carol Adams, I love using her book, Pornography of Meat, and it's brilliant. And the ideas in there and how they connect to the mainstream feminism, if one is willing to do so, is a real eye-opener. In fact, just this last week I had the good fortune, someone else teaches a feminism class on campus too, and one of my students was in there, and he said, you know, she never talks about animals or nature. And he said, can you help me? And I said, I know just the book for you. And he is so happy to have it. And so now the other teacher is being introduced to these ideas.
Sounds good. And where did the idea for sister species come from, and how did that shift from the idea you first had of the book to what it turned out to be?
Oh, boy, I started out wanting to do an anthology of women's voices. I'm so well aware that women are the backbone of the movement. And when I went to my first AR conference, I was just disappointed because I saw the movement as something that wasn't mainstream. And yet when I got there, the mainstream patriarchy was like an overlay over just the conference. I don't think it's true of the movement as a whole, as it is with the environmental movement. It is very much run by males. It's the voice of men. But the animal rights movement hasn't been. We have powerful women running it. But at the AR conference, it is men running it, and there is, to this day, almost no mention of the ecofeminists or Carol Adams' work, unless someone like Patrice Jones or myself is there asking for a spot and trying to get this added to the program. They won't do it themselves. And just recently, the whole conference has been handed over to yet another young male. And it's going to be, well, not another yet another young male, but to another male. He's now young, and who knows how long he will keep the task. But or whether or not he'll be open to these different ideas, it will be interesting to see. So when I first went to the conference, I was disappointed. And it kind of helped me want to work in that field and learn more about it. And then my sister suggested that I do an anthology on of women working with animals. So that's what I started. And I was collecting all these wonderful, incredible, powerful, foundational voices and people doing so much. These women that are just, I just admire them so much, their strength and their courage and what they're doing for animals. And then when I got the whole anthology done and I was so excited about it, the publisher that I was working with wanted to break the book up. No, I'm sorry, that's not right. The publisher wanted to pick and choose. She said, oh, you've got lots of essays. Let's just take some of them. I'm like, oh, no, you don't. These are all great essays, and they're all getting into print. And so I decided to divide the book into two. So the foundation of both of these books came from the same place. And then in order to make sure all of their work was honored and all of their voices were heard, I simply focused one book on connections with other forms of oppression, which is sister species, versus speaking up for animals, which is still completely, it's international, it's very multicultural, it has, you know, same groups of powerful activists, but they're focused, I don't want to say exclusively, but they're very focused. And I don't want to say it's focused on feminism, because that wasn't the intent of the book. It's to highlight the work they're doing. So the difference would be that speaking up for animals is the wonderful voices of these powerful women working for animals, whereas sister species has an element of, say, gay activism or anti-racism and those other sorts of things.
And I noticed in both of them, in the introduction to Speaking Up for Animals and in the appendix of Sister Species, you talked about how female-bodied non-humans get kind of the brunt of the exploitation. And can you tell me about why you felt it was so important to point that out?
Well, for one thing, I didn't know it and never really thought about it. And as I worked on the book and got ready to go to press, when the book went out and reviewers read it, and I'm pretty sure it was Carolina who said it, she said, now when you write an introduction, you need to do a framework for the book. And I thought, well, I really have no idea how to write an introduction. I really have no idea what a framework looks like, and I really don't know how to do that. But in the course of figuring that out and putting together the introductions for these books, I discovered tighter links between feminism and animal activism and why there should be no feminists who aren't animal activists and no animal activists who aren't feminists. So in the course of learning all of that, I looked at the animals that are being exploited and who's being hurt and how and why. and how that connects with feminism. And sure, you know, the previous thinkers, you know, and it's not just Carol Adams. She's the one who, from my perspective, has probably written the most clearly on it. But there's the work of Greta Garg. There's Marty Keel. There's now Patrice Jones. There's just a terrific bunch of thinkers out there pulling this stuff together. So I had all these leads to help me. So this doesn't come from me. This comes from a group of women working on these ideas. So looking at, let's say, cows exploited for dairy products. If you look at a cow killed for beef, that cow, I mean, I'm in Montana. I know how they spend their first 6 months. They're out on the prairie. Then they get horrifically rounded up and put in the transport trucks and sent off. And, you know, for 2 to 4 months, their lives are ghastly, and then their slaughter is awful. With dairy cattle, it's an unending process from birth to death, and it can last 6 years, and they have additional trauma, emotional trauma added, because they are forcibly impregnated, because they have wombs and vaginas that people can enter and put seeds in there. They are forced to constantly be pregnant so that they will lactate. They're not going to lactate unless they've given birth. So they have the emotional trauma of having their calves stolen as soon as they're out. Of course, any animal will try to protect their babies. So their babies are stolen, and of course the babies are treated horrifically as well, but the poor cow stays there and is milked. We steal the milk and drink the milk that is the baby's, her nursing milk, and she's again impregnated and goes through this process 5 or 6 times until she's spent because it's so hard on her body. And then she is, of course, goes through the same process the males go through of being herded, sent off in horrible transport and ghastly slaughter. So that's one example of how, as a female in the cattle industry, the females suffer longer and have additional pains added to what they go through. And it's the same, of course, for sows, who are, again, forcibly impregnated and repeatedly have broods that are taken from them and manipulated, and their whole biology is manipulated because they are females. And with hens, same thing. And again, I'd say that the intense suffering of the sows, the hens, and the dairy cattle used by the dairy industry is just intense and beyond what males suffer. And in the hen industry, of course, the males are killed straight away. They're put through the grinder or suffocated or however they're disposed of, and it's awful. But on the other hand, the females are kept alive only to suffer, you know, week after week and month after month, because they have reproductive eggs, the same as female humans do, that are passed at regular intervals and taken from them and sold and consumed by human beings. So these females are suffering because they have female bodies, in the same way that women suffer because they have female bodies, vaginas that can be penetrated, wombs that can be filled, and breasts that some men sometimes think are there for them rather than, you know, they're for feeding babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you pointed out in the introduction to Sister Species, which is quite in depth, about the link between patriarchy and pastoralism, which I hadn't really thought of before. Can you expand on that idea a bit?
All right, so looking at the connections between patriarchy and pastoralism, the idea of pastoralism is that you control other animals for what you can get from them. So, and one of the hallmarks that, again, great women thinkers have figured out is that one of the problems with patriarchy is that males are very controlling in patriarchy, and one of the things that they control is female bodies, just as they do to cows and sows and hens, but they also, of course, control the womb that they're married to. So just as a man will marry so that he has claim to a womb, surprise, surprise, that fooling around amongst males is much more acceptable in our society than among females, because that womb is claimed once you're married. And while the man can never really know who his kids are, a woman knows. So this whole idea of marriage was about a man knowing which womb was his and then controlling the woman, the womb, so that everything, and the vagina, controlling her body, so that what came out of her was his progeny, because property was passed down to male lines and he needed sons to carry on his work or to inherit his wealth. So similarly, in the pastoral world, the husbandry, if you will. It's like husbands. They are controlling other species for the benefits. They keep them pregnant. They want females to give birth so that they can sell them. So they are profiting, manipulating the bodies of herds of animals in order to create offspring, all of which they control as if it was mere property and sell for their profits.
I would expect that people would get that connection and see that the types of oppression are linked, but it seems to be not actually that common that people fighting for other social justice causes quite get that connection. Can you just tell me a bit about some of the responses to speciesism being brought up? What's the response you get from people who haven't quite thought of that before?
I love how you worded it, that you would expect, and that in fact it has not proven to be true, because that is exactly what I think people need to hear, that yes, this seems, once you hear it, you go, oh yeah, and then you expect others to go, oh yeah, or maybe even already get it, but sure enough, that's not the case. But once you understand patriarchy and you get to A, not A, I think it's easier to understand that those in the A category never want to give up their privilege and their power. They don't want to stop exploiting because there's something in it for them. What they want is to move themselves into the A category, but they want to leave, and I shouldn't, when I say they, those who who resist this, they don't want to find themselves in the not A category anymore. They want to move over in the A category, but they're quite comfortable leaving others in the not A category. And when I say that, I haven't said it right, because if you put it to them that way, they'd say, no, wait a minute. It's not that we want only ourselves to not be oppressed and everything else oppressed. I mean, that's not how they would word it. So I think it just takes time for them to see that that is, in fact, what they're doing. When you look at it point blank, that is what they're doing. But I think you also have to see that as an oppressed category. Well, I remember when I was getting my master's degree, and they were putting mouse traps in the kitchen area, and I would go and spring them, and I would do more than spring them, but I did not like how they were handling the situation. And I remember the conflicts I had in talking about this with what I found to be a very upset population of African Americans who themselves had been experiencing prejudice all their lives, and here I was worried about a mouse, and they just felt like there was something. And here I was, this lily white happy female that had, I had experienced sexism all my life, but compared to what they'd been through, especially the African American females, it just to them was, it got under their skin that I was worried about a mouse. So you have to try to see this from their perspective, if you can, when you bump into somebody that resists. And when I gave my first talk on this at Stony Brook, and boy howdy, I was not ready for the response. I was attacked. Again, part of this, my own fault for my own ignorance and my background that I come through, that I just don't really understand the anger that's out there and that surrounds some of the people that are working so hard to bring these changes. And then when you bring in something that they see as conflicting with it or muddying the waters, they are not happy. So I was roundly attacked on a whole lot of levels by most of the people there. And finally, there was one other animal activist there who simply pointed out, of course they're fighting it. This isn't the first time you've seen this. Just because they're feminist doesn't mean they're going to say, you're right, we'll change our diet. Of course we're exploiting these other creatures, and we're going to quit doing it. It's just not going to happen. It takes time, it takes patience, and it takes working with people.
Speaking of working with people, now to turn that around, how do activists who work for non-human liberation work towards a deeper understanding of oppression and build solidarity with the feminist movement?
Oh, it's so important that we do this. It's a critical question. And the first thing I would say is we need to ask a whole bunch of different people this. And all I can give you is my struggling journey answer, that I'm still on my way here and have learned a whole lot in the last 5 years. But compared to many people, especially people who are people like Breeze Harper, who's African-American and an animal activist and a feminist, she's going to have terrific, and she has books out there, by the way. She has Sister Vegan. So there's works out there that we can look at to help understand these broader perspectives. My sense is that base level, we care about suffering. So we can't limit that to, well, we only care about white cows. Okay, we'll add black chickens. So we have to say that if suffering matters, it matters wherever it exists. Now, yes, you can say, well, there's more suffering and less suffering. It's absolutely true. And this is why, first and foremost, I am an animal activist. The numbers and the extent of the suffering is greater than any other category out there that I know of. And when and if someone shows me a category that's suffering more, I will look at it. And if I agree, then it makes sense for me to switch. Then it would make sense for me to switch. But, you know, we don't have to do that. My main point is choose what you want to fight for. If you're a feminist, if you're working against racism, if you're working for animals, choose it and do it wholeheartedly. They all need work. It's all important work. But, and here's the one that animal rights activists, I think, are especially guilty of. We need to be educated. We need to understand that if we don't like suffering, our ignorance perpetuates suffering. That we're being elitists if we think that only our problem, only our issue matters. Our issue is animal activism, animal suffering. It is linked to these other forms of oppression. It is linked because they're all in the not A category. And we have to destroy the structures that lie behind and support these forms of oppression. So what we have to do at a minimum, and this is what I'll tell my feminist friends, I say, well, fine, you know, I don't mind at all that I love that you're fighting for what you're fighting for. Keep it up. But could you think about some dietary changes? And I'll help you with it. I can get you some recipes. We can try one meal a week. We can move in that direction. I can tell you just a few things that maybe you should never eat, like veal. And, you know, maybe moving away from cheese and eggs, because that's where the females are suffering the most. So working with people, supporting other activists in what they're trying to change because it's all important, and making sure we understand racism and so that we aren't contributing to it. Just like I want her to keep fighting for feminism, please don't hurt what I'm doing. Don't keep eating what you're eating. Don't go to circuses. Don't wear fur. Don't support vivisection. She can completely keep fighting for what she's fighting for without hurting what I'm doing. So I need to do the same. I need to keep fighting what I'm fighting for, but I need to understand how not to contribute to racism and sexism and other forms of oppression, heterosexism, homophobia, those sorts of things that are out there.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, and that was an interview with philosopher-activist Lisa Kammerer. Her books Sister Species and Speaking Up for Animals are not available in the Vancouver libraries right now, but you can always request books. You can purchase the books online, or you can order them at your local bookstore.
Go ahead. You can say it. Use the F word. We say it live on the radio. Maybe you've heard. Mondays at noon, we go for an hour. We talk about culture, gender, race, class, and power. We're bringing sexy back under attack. Because it's about time folks started taking some flack for promoting a culture where you must be a pessimist. If you want to speak your mind and say something feminist. But we know it's not true. From the truth you can't run. Feminists simply have so much more fun. If the trash that you hear makes you angry or bored, check out the F word at feminisms.org.
Eating animals acts as mirror and representation of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. The patriarchal gaze sees not the fragmented flesh of dead animals, but appetizing food. Vegetarian activities counter patriarchal consumption and challenge the consumption of death. Feminist vegetarian activity declares that an alternative worldview exists, one which celebrates life rather than consuming death, one which does not rely on resurrected animals, but empowered people. We'll be right back. and the presence of meat proclaims the disempowering of women.
This was Sexual Politics of Meat by Consolidated, and you are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, broadcasting live from the downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. And tying in with the song we just heard, Carol J. Adams' book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, which was published in 1990, is without question a groundbreaking book. Adams drew links between meat eating and patriarchy and presented the theory that animal rights and feminism are interconnected. I've heard that her book has become a required reading in many gender study classes, and Adams herself quotes her publisher that it has become a classic. However, maybe a classic by his definition is a book that you're expected to know about but not expected to have read. And I have to admit for myself that is true. I haven't read The Sexual Politics of Meat yet. Have you, Alyssa or Jackie?
I did many years ago, but I have read The Pornography of Meat more recently. Yep.
I haven't yet read the book, but that's definitely on my list.
Well, now it's Kara Davis and Wendy Lee have published an anthology called Defiant Daughters, and that is a collection of 21 essays by women on art, activism, animals, and the sexual politics of meat. So it shows that the sexual politics of meat is indeed still read and is a impactful book.
Over 20 years later. Yeah, it seems I'm really excited about this book, and what I like about it is that it seems like a book of praxis, of putting theory in action. And how that book has affected people over the years.
Exactly. The publisher says that you should be familiar with Adams' theories to read the book. But actually, I have to say myself, I'm not that familiar with her. I know her theories, but I haven't read her book. But still, I found The Defiant Daughters very interesting because the essays I've read, they're all like very personal stories. And the contributors to the book are of very diverse background. You have chefs there, cooks there, students, professors. The youngest one is, I think, just maybe 17 years old, and others are in their 40s. And
so artists, too.
Artists, yeah. So basically, most essays kind of describe how the writers got introduced to the sexual politics of meat and what it meant for them and for their journey. And reading these stories alone, I found very, very inspiring and very interesting to see what an impact it indeed has still today.
Mm-hmm. I read a couple essays in the book so far. One was called Brother Knows Best, written by Sarah E. Brown. She runs the queerveganfood.com blog, and she was actually featured on Animal Voices in July of 2012 on our Queer Liberation and Fat Positive Veganism show.
I recently got her cookbook, the Queer Vegan Cookbook.
Oh,
it's an e-book published through her website.
Nice.
I bought it. It's great.
Nice. So her essay was about how she found the book on her brother's bookshelf. He was much older in college. She read it when she was, I guess early college, maybe 17. And then she came out as a lesbian and as a vegan at the same time. And it was about how, yeah, her brother then went vegan a few weeks after she just told him why, and he got it. And yeah, I really enjoyed that story. And then the other one I read was called Beyond Band-Aid Work by Ashley Meyer, who created Because We Must, an organization based on connectionism, I guess. She calls herself a connectionist. And she wrote how she works to prevent sexual violence. And her success kind of at the end of the story was 12 years after trying to get into conferences to talk about these connections between animal abuse and sexual violence against women, she finally got a talk in one of the conferences about rape culture. So, yeah, that was. I'm really excited about this book, and I hope.
Great book.
Yeah, we'll feature an interview about it in future. And yeah, now we have on the phone with us a very special guest. Fireweed is an artist, photographer, who's been active for many years as an eco-feminist in the social justice, environmental, and animal rights movements. She was a featured writer in another anthology edited by our earlier guest, Lisa Kammerer, called Call to Compassion, Religious Perspectives on Animal Advocacy. Fireweed, thank you so much for joining Animal Voices today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Lisa, and I want to start by saying congratulations to Lisa on her latest anthology, Defiant Daughters. Sounds great. But also a very hearty, happy International Women's Day to all of you there at Animal Voices, and a shout-out, appreciation for all the fine work you're doing, lending the female voice to animals. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Just to note, though, Defiant Daughters is not edited by Lisa Kammerer. It's Kara Davis and Wendy Lee. But yes, so I would like to... The reason why I called you or decided to speak to you today was because just kind of jumping off of Defiant Daughters, how this book is about women who've been changed by the concepts in the sexual politics of meat and how they put that theory into action. And I thought you were a really great local example of that. And so my first question is, tell us about how the sexual politics of meat has changed your life and actions.
Wow. In every way imaginable, I would say, Elisa, and let me correct my earlier recognition of Defiant Daughters and appreciate those who were actually responsible for putting the anthology together. I think that, like Lisa, those editors that were responsible for this latest book are all trying to highlight the fact that the personal is political, which has been a very important part of how the sexual politics of meat has affected my own life and my own efforts, actually, to support the voices of women around intersectionality of oppression. I guess I started out in the early 90s really putting my awareness of ecofeminism and intersectionality into practice with the Women in the Earth series that I initiated in Vancouver back then. It was a concert series that ran for several years, actually two conferences and a series of workshops that invited women to speak from their own voices about their work in the world as social change and environmental activists. And it wasn't centered specifically on animal rights by a long shot. Women from various sectors of social change and environmental activism were part of the celebration, also artists. And to this day, I continue to look for opportunities to highlight the work of women who work in a variety of ways around the issues of liberation, as Lisa stressed in her interview, which was excellent, by the way, and thank you for featuring her today. We need to remember that all oppressions are interconnected, and part of ecofeminism, I think, is understanding that it's not really useful to prioritize one oppression over another. While we may choose to focus in one particular area, we always need to remember how they are intersecting so that we are, in fact, all working towards the mutual goal of liberation for all.
Thank you. So it sounds like it did definitely make a big impression on your life and work. And, well, starting in the 90s, I guess, I mean, the book came out in 1990, and, it sounds like it really fueled your fire. Speaking of fire, actually.
You know, I remember the day it came out. Shall I tell you about that?
Oh, yeah, please.
Because I was thinking about that before the show. I was having some flashbacks that really I'd forgotten about until just last night when I was thinking and prepping for the show, how I had originally been influenced by Marty Keel, who you did an excellent show around back in November, shortly after the conference that commemorated her work as an eco-feminist scholar, animal rights scholar. and thank you for that. Marty got to me, shall we say, before The Sexual Politics of Meat by Carol Adams did. I had met Marty at a gathering of the Greens in California, I think in the late 80s, and that's where I first saw the Sexual Politics of Meat slideshow. Marty, for your listeners who may not be familiar with her work, was the founder of Feminists for Animal Rights. And at that time, I was working as an artist with animal products in my artwork, and I really believed I was using them in a very sacred and reverential manner, in a respectful way as a mixed media artist. And the Sexual Politics of Meat slideshow really turned that around for me, and I never been the same since. But just to back up, around the same time, I ended up getting, it was a pivotal period of time there of about maybe 2 years where everything just shifted for me, and I ended up getting a job at the first animal rights store in Canada, which was in on Vancouver's west side. I don't know if you remember Animal Free Trade. It was on 4th Avenue for several years, beginning in the late 80s through the early 90s. And it was started by Bob Korish, who is one of the founders of the Coalition for No Whales in Captivity Period. He later moved back to the States and sadly passed away in 2011. But I had the opportunity to go to work for Bob at the store, and it was a bit of an uphill battle, as it still is today, to make the links between speciesism and sexism explicit. But I was really inspired, having met Marty, and then was waiting for the Sexual Politics of Meat book to come out by Carol. And when it finally did, it was a real coup for me to see that book on display in the window of Animal Free Trade alongside the other animal advocacy books that we sold in the shop. But eventually I did have to leave that job because I ended up being, you know, fed up with the patriarchal posturing that I had to put up with as a result of being there. And I would say that probably that was the first time that the Sexual Politics of Meat literally changed my career direction, shall we say, but it certainly wasn't the last, and it has continued to influence all the work that I do as an activist, as an artist, in the various ways that I organize in my community. So it's with me all the time. I think that once you put on that, I think of ecofeminism as a lens through which we have a better picture and understanding of power and privilege. And I think once you put those glasses on, it's impossible to take them off. So you start to see the world through that analysis, and so I really credit Carol Adams, but also Marty Keogh and all the women, those early pioneers, and the women that continue today to promote the message that sexism and speciesism are absolutely interconnected. So I'll stop rambling here and let you get another question in for me.
Yeah, well, I mostly just want to talk about how you put that that philosophy into action. I know you're very, very active in your community. You run community vegan potlucks once a month. Can you talk about that and how that fits into your philosophy?
Sure. Actually, we're running our potluck series just 4 times a year now.
Okay.
We did start out by doing it every month, and this was back in the mid-90s. So I've been at this for a long time in my community. We've had people in to talk about the sexual politics of meat, but in general, the potluck series reflects on social justice and environmental themes, linking those to around sitting down to a plant-based meal that we can share in our community. And I've emphasized over the years how plant-based fare is inclusive. It's still an uphill battle trying to get people to not think about vegan dining is exclusionary. It's been my ongoing mantra that this is food that we can all share that leaves no one out. And so I think it's been an important way to bring people to the table, shall we say, around the power of our individual choices. And so we don't always feature the politics of food in our after-dinner presentations. But this month, for example, we're going to be showing The Symphony of Soil, which is a new film that has come out just last year by Deborah Coons Garcia, that looks at how soil is created over centuries and the intricate relationship of plants, animals, and the land, and how precious this resource is. Because I think fundamentally, our food, you know, originates with taking care of the land, and so food on every single level links us to respect for this planet. And so, you know, from the people that prepare food predominantly as women and make still, I think, the majority of choices in kitchens around the world, to how our food is raised, you know, all of these things can be viewed through an ecofeminist lens. And so while I may not talk about ecofeminism or the sexual politics of meat, as I mentioned, at each of these potlucks, it's always in the back of my mind how these various aspects of our relationship to one another and the food we need to intersect, and of course, to the animals that we are choosing to not consume at these events.
Let's talk more about your food justice work. I know you coined the term veganiculture. What exactly does that refer to?
Well, you know, 20 years ago I left Vancouver and decided to study organic farming at a wonderful farm on Cortez Island, just up the road from where I live today. And because permaculture had inspired me deeply, and permaculture, I don't want to get too carried away in talking about the definitions here, but in a nutshell, I would say that permaculture is about reevaluating our relationship to the land, learning how to live in place, with a set of guidelines that maximizes energy in the system, reduces our dependency on external imports, and teaches us to live as sustainably as possible, as I say, maximizing resources. But traditionally, it's a fairly patriarchal. It was used in a way that incorporates a lot of animal husbandry, and that doesn't have to be the way things are with permaculture. We can borrow the ideas behind permaculture that honor humans and the land and surplus, giving away excess. It's a very holistic systems-based approach to still living and growing food. Veganic agriculture is similarly a way of working with the land to produce food in a sustainable way, but that excludes the use of animal inputs. So I thought it was important that this new movement in veganic agriculture, also called stock-free agriculture, was combined with the principles of permaculture in a way that recognizes our choices as vegans to live holistically. I hope I'm making sense. It's a little difficult to put this into a nutshell, but I basically have combined two words, veganic agriculture and permaculture, to reflect the adoption of veganic principles, particularly by vegans, to choose to live in a manner that really honors this whole systems theory of living on the land sustainably and in a way that extends our circle of compassion to other beings. Of course, we are always going to be interacting in nature with wildlife, and there is no way to exclude all animals, nor would we wish to, from a growing system, because the soil itself is alive, and that's part of what our film, this month of Pollock series, will feature on. It is already teeming with life, but it is fairly unrecognized still today that it is completely unnecessary to have animal inputs to grow healthy organic food, similar to the way that there's still this myth that one needs to consume meat to be healthy and strong. There's this belief that we need to have animal manure or blood meal and various bone meal, other things that are added traditionally still today in organic agricultural systems to the soil in order for it to be fertility. But we do not need to pass the plants that are really the origin of the nutrients that the soil requires to be healthy through the body of an animal, any more than we need to consume the bodies of animals ourselves to gain the nutrients that we require to be healthy as human beings. So does that make sense?
Definitely, yeah. So through your work in creating the Denman Island Veganiculture Association, or DEVA, how do you outreach that message, or what's your intent with that group?
Well, you know, because we're living in a rural community and the vegan community here is very small. We only have a thousand people where I live. And, of course, if you look at any sector of society anywhere, a very small percentage of people still are vegan. So in a community this size, you can imagine it's particularly small. But we probably have more people here who practice a vegan diet and certainly a vegetarian diet than in a lot of other places. But the outreach that, we do in having a presence on the web, for example, is really more applicable to connecting with others in a broader sense. So, you know, we have our presence on a variety of blogs and sites that I have online, linked to our potluck series, for example, which also is a resource online for people looking to further their understanding of plant-based nutrition and all the various reasons why choosing to low in the food chain is very important for our personal health, for the environment, and for animals. I outreach, you know, through Diva that way as well. But we connect people through the website and in daily conversations as well around the politics of food in our community too, to some of the larger organizations that are connecting up internationally, including the Vegan Organic Network out of the UK and the Vegan Agricultural Organization out of Quebec here in North America, linking people up. So I think social networking is extremely important for those of us who are living in these small rural communities, especially with the increase in interest in locavorism and the challenge that many of us face now that raising animals locally is taking precedence in, you know, environmentally aware circles over necessarily simply choosing to eat lower in the food chain. There are some real challenges there that we have to meet. So sharing information about the ways that stock-free growing are advantageous is extremely, extremely important. We have one model here on Denman Island of stock-free techniques being very successful in a community-based project, and that is our community potato co-op. It's a project that I helped start 6 years ago now here on Denman, and while it's not an official veganic example, we do care for the land veganically through the use of cover crops and crop rotation, and we abstain from the use of any animal inputs in the system. And are now, in, as I mentioned, our sixth growing season, an example of how successful those techniques are. So I think there are other people gardening and farming veganically that don't have a lot of time to be online. It takes a lot of effort to be engaged in farming, and I'm trying to hook up with those people through the blog for Diva, and again through Facebook, which is a great tool for linking up ecofeminists of all kinds as well.
Great.
That's one example.
Awesome. And just we only have just 1 minute left. Just very quickly, how can people learn more? And then I'll mention your essay. But how can people get in touch with you online and learn more about your work?
Well, they can contact me through my Facebook page, and you can always look for me under the name Fireweed. But you should probably know that I show up predominantly on Facebook as Diane Radmore, which is my legal name. It's a long story of how Facebook acts my Fireweed page, but either one will usually get to me, although there are a couple other Fireweeds out there. So remember Diane Radmore. Hook up with me that way. Or connect with me through Diva, the Denman Isle of Veganiculture Association,
okay.
Or the Denman Potluck Series, or any one of a number of other blogs. If you Google Fireweed and Denman Island, they should pop up, and that's one way of connecting with me.
Sounds good. So, and if you want,
so much more to talk about. The time just flew by.
Oh no! And if you want to read the essay that Fireweed submitted to the book, check it out. The book is called "Call to Compassion: Religious Perspectives on Animal Advocacy." And Fireweed's essay in that book is called "Wicca, Ecofeminism, and Animal Advocacy: The Earth Path Less Traveled." Thank you for joining us today, Fireweed. We'll hopefully talk to you again in a future show.
Thanks so much, Alyssa. Take care.
Bye bye.
I think we really have to go to Denman Island.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Field trip. So you are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM, CFRO broadcasting live from downtown Eastside on unceded Coast Salish territories. And I just wanted to mention quickly, Vancouver Vegan Prom is taking place March 9th. That's tomorrow. I know, it's exciting. It's getting down to the wire.
Dun, dun, dun,
dun. Yeah.
Superhero theme.
For those of you that tuned in to last week's show, you heard Jenny's theme song for the event. So if you're excited to sing that, hopefully at the event, come by. So this is a 19-plus event only, so please leave your kids at home. And this is a great event. Tickets are available for $18 online at veganprom.ca, or you can also buy them at the door for $20. And just dress up as your favorite superhero. Get out some costumes. Make something. Make a cape out of a sheet like I did.
Or just dress casually.
Or, yeah, dress
Everyone
casually.
Everyone welcome.
Or, yeah.
Do you guys have superhero names already?
I'm working on something.
I want like a ray gun, because my name is Alyssa Ray. I want like a ray gun of light that exposes the shadows.
I like that. All right. So, on next week's show, we will be speaking with Michael Weber, Executive Director of Farm Animal Rights Movement. Also, we will chat with Paul Shapiro, Vice President of HSUS, about the trends of meat consumption in the U.S. And we here at Animal Voices Show modestly ask that you keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. Join us on Twitter, Animal Voices YVR. And please send us your suggestions and comments about the show on Facebook or via email, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And also check out our website for podcasts and shows can be downloaded at animalvoices.org. And if you appreciate the work that we do, we ask you to bring to make some donations at cooperadio.org. All right, and we'll be leaving you with a clip from one of Fireweed's favorite songs, It Won't Take Long, by the iconic Canadian lesbian feminist musician and poet, Farron.
They said some men would be warriors, and some men would be kings. And some men would be owners of land and other man-made things. False love as the eternal flame would move some to think in rings. And gold would be our power and other foolish things. Dream of liberty, must not yourselves be fooled. Before you get the plea for freedom, you have agreed to be in rule. If the body stays a shackle, then the mind remains a chain. That'll link you to a destiny whereby all good souls are slain. And it won't take long. It won't take too long at all. It won't take long. Say, I don't know what you are talking about, and I say, you mean to tell me that's all? Of three men in a desert wandering, one is knowing and two are scared. They say time is in the river, but the river is not there. Dry in spirit, dry in body, who will lend themselves to death? And in grief one weeps into his hands and drinks his bitter tears. Cause it don't take long, it don't take too long at all. It don't take long. You may say, I don't know what you are talking about, and I say, you mean to tell me that's all? And as I stand before you, I am hopeful in my rage. You know love has finally called for me. I will not wilt upon its stage. But still smaller than my nightmare now, do I print upon the page? Do we have to live inside its walls to identify the cage? Cause it takes so long. Why does it take so long? But it takes so long. Say, I don't care what you're talking about, and I say, are you trying to say it don't belong? Mm-hmm. myself in you. It's this blessing that I follow now, and so I must speak true. I dreamed of thousands dying, it was you and you and you. And while the city sleeps so quietly, there is something that we must do, and it won't take long. Say, I don't want to know what you're talking about, and it makes me want to say, so on. Cause grief shall come in measures, only grief alone will know. And you'll see it on your family, on your own face it will grow. And they'll try to keep you hungry, and then they'll tell you to eat snow. You know, pride can be a moving thing if you learn the strength of no. It won't take long.
It won't take too long
at all. It won't take long. And you may say, I don't think this has anything to do with me. But did you ever think you could be wrong? Coming, human strength will fill the streets of every city on our planet. Hear the sound of angry feet. The business freezed up in the harbor, the kings will pull up on their hair, and the banks will shudder to a halt, and the artists will be there. Cause it won't take long. It won't take too long at all. It won't take long. Say, I don't know how to be a part of that. It makes me want to say, don't you want to see yourself that strong? The division between the peoples will disappear that on their day. And though oceans lie between us, lifted candles light the way. Half will join their hands by moonlight, the rest under a rising sun. The sun beneath the sun and moon, our ritual wailing has begun. And it won't take long. It won't take too long at all. It won't take long. And you may say, I'm afraid to be a part of that. That makes me wanna say, come on. Sagging diplomats, where you will not hear one gun. And though our homes be torn and ransacked, we will not be undone. For as we let ourselves be bought, we're gonna let ourselves be free. And if you think we stand alone, look again and you will see. We are children in the rafters, we are babies in the park. We are lovers at the movies. We are candles in the dark. We are changes in the weather. We are snowflakes in July. We are women grown together. We are men who easily cry. We are words not quickly spoken. We're the deeper side of pride. We are dreamers in the making. We are not afraid of